That's where on stage I can finally say I love what I do for a living. But still, most days I can't wait until I'm done and allowed to go, which is almost never. And despite my poor track record at restaurants, bars, salons, and mailrooms, yes, I once got fired from a mailroom for throwing away the mail, I'm proud to say I've never been fired from a show business job. Once on a small one-episode TV role, I was told I'd be canned if I didn't stop ad-libbing inappropriate jokes. But that's the closest I ever came. And now that I'm a boss, and it's part of my job to do the hiring and firing, I get what it feels like to have people's fate in your hands. It's not a sensation I enjoy. Turns out being on the other side can also be full of humiliation and hardship. But it still beats working for someone else, and there's no turning back once you get used to running the show. I got my very first brief taste of being in charge at the age of 10, when I was a basketball referee for a little kids' league. I'd wake up early Saturday mornings and put on my striped shirt and hang the whistle around my neck like a girl boss. Literally. I was still physically a little girl and hadn't even started my period yet, but I was made for that job. It wasn't easy because the parents were bloodthirsty and insane. The kids were 6 years old who couldn't even lace up their own shoes, but these parents were calling for technical fouls. I threw my fair share of them out of the game. I'd call traveling on one of the kids and the father would literally get in my face, my 10-year-old 3'11" face, and yell, "Terrible call!" I'd blow my whistle and point to the door, and the angry adult would leave the room in a huff. It was the most difficult job I've had to date, harder even than hauling three obese men from Green Bay uphill in a pedicab. But somehow I think that job prepared me for everything I do now. It prepared me for being a female boss in an industry that is still mostly run by men. It prepared me for being called fat, ugly, and talentless on the internet. Because I assure you, every troll online is even more vitriolic and nasty than those adults getting in my face on the basketball court. And it prepared me to get up early, work my ass off, and stand by my calls. Today I wake up every day, mostly with way too much work on my plate and not enough hours to get it all done. I worry about the people on my payroll, that if I don't do a good job, they'll be affected. I try to treat everyone equally, badly, JK, just equally. I do my best to make decisions that are fair and good for me and everyone else. I'm tired and beaten down a lot of the time, but it still feels so fucking good to know that no matter who or what comes at me, this is my court and I wear the whistle. Excerpt from my journal in 2001, age 20, with footnotes from 2016. I got home around 2:50. Footnote. Wow, very precise. What is this, Law and Order? Today I went with my mom and Kim to meet Jay at LaGuardia. We got to meet his good friend from school, Eileen. Throughout the weekend, he made his usual fat jokes about me. Footnote. I honestly don't remember my brother making fun of my weight at all. I remember him making sure my ego was in check and that I never got too full of myself. And Kim looked so wonderful and thin. Footnote. I had no idea that she was battling an eating disorder at the time. And I felt so heavy, and the mixture of all of that has made me decide to try to develop an eating disorder. Footnote. I had no idea that she was battling an eating disorder at the time. Hopefully, it will safely work out. Footnote. Like they always do. I'm sick of feeling confident and then suddenly self-conscious. Footnote. Well, get used to it, bitch. It's for the rest of your life. It's too hard. I've become something I never thought I would. I've never had any real issue with my weight, but I'm seeing Dan in 3 weeks, and I'm sick of being looked at as the big girl. I want to feel what it's like to be considered really hot. I hate that this is such a priority to me, but right now it just is. Footnote. I understand what I'm saying here. Feeling this way is a theme in every girl's life, I think. And at that age, you think there's some other version of yourself that is waiting to come out and blow everyone's dick off. I am so glad this is almost 15 years ago, and I know myself and my body now. Sorry, girls this age, but if you can, just skip the self-hatred and the striving to be some other type of girl. Just let that phase pass you by and love yourself how you are. Don't waste any energy on it. If you want to lose a little weight, fine. Make sure you are healthy, but fuck, skip all the rest. You are hot, and the person who will love you won't notice 10 pounds. I really promise. I can just see myself reading this entry when I'm recovering from the disorder and gaining back the weight, but I have to give it a shot. Footnote. Not only was I so confident in my ability to develop an efficient eating disorder, but I was also certain I would recover from it. Do you think I get ahead of myself? I've tried everything else. Footnote. Except for not drinking like Nick Cage and leaving Las Vegas. If I don't look much better than now, I will refuse to see Dan. I want to see him and feel thin and beautiful or not see him at all. Footnote. This was the boyfriend who made me feel bad about myself and my body, so I would have low self-esteem and he wouldn't lose me. More on this prize later. This is such a humiliating thing to actually write down, but I'm sort of depressed, and I've worked pretty hard, and this is just how I feel. So be it. We'll see what happens. Love, Amy. P.S. I guess Dan has too much power over me. I need something else. I've been seriously thinking about the AmeriCorps. Hell yeah! Footnote. That is like the Peace Corps, but in America, which my brother did, which I never even came close to doing. I am a flake. Also, hell yeah. Yikes. I wish it was now. I should be enjoying college, not praying for it to end. Footnote. That is not true. That is exactly what I should have been doing. People who enjoy high school or college too much are whack, in my humble opinion. What the fuck? I want to go to NYU so bad. Footnote. I don't remember ever thinking that. Towson sucks. Baltimore is bullshit. Footnote. I disagree with myself here. Baltimore is not bullshit. I grew to really love it. Get me the fuck out of here. Footnote. Many people think I have this unshakable confidence, so I hope this look into my most intimate thoughts will support the idea that loving yourself takes time. Like any healthy relationship, it doesn't happen overnight. And sometimes it can only come to fruition after several failed attempts at eating disorders. A few days later. Dear Journal, it's been 2 weeks since my last confession. Haha. Footnote. What a heck. I seriously thought I was Woody Allen. I just read over my previous journal entry. It makes me sick. Footnote. My emotional swings in my 20s were like those of someone with multiple personality disorder. I don't feel that way at all right now about my body. I like my body. Footnote. Oh, okay, boo-boo. Before hooking up with Dan, I never had a real issue with it. Footnote. I was putting the pieces together that this guy was treating me like garbage. If he continues to make me feel self-conscious, I really don't want to communicate with him anymore. Footnote. Yeah, bitch. I want to jump off the couch and celebrate for this girl. Follow this girl, ladies. I feel pretty good about myself and my weight right now. Anyway, I'm on a plane on my way to visit Dan. Ha ha. Again, with a mere mention of a visit, I'm on a plane to go see this little bastard. Footnote. Turns out I was right. He was a bastard. I hope we have so much fun. I just don't want to take this too seriously. Footnote. Hear me now. The I'm just gonna have fun and not be attached tactic has never and will never work, sisters. I do not know one girl who wants to get a bunch of different dick. We aren't wired that way, honeys. He is my friend who I love on a deeper level than other friends. The sex certainly completes it, but that's just a factor of our friendship. Footnote. Damn, can you hear me lying to myself even on the page? I'm excited to see how this weekend goes. It's Thursday right now, and I'm staying till Sunday. Footnote. Okay, I googled it, and that checks out. It was a Thursday. It was also my brother's birthday. Happy belated, Jay. Beautiful and strong. Right before I left for college, I was running my high school. I knew where to park, where to get the best chicken cutlet sandwich, and which custodians had pot. People knew me. They liked me. I was an athlete and a good friend, and I felt pretty. I felt seen. I had reached my full high school potential. I had an identity. I was looked at as strong, funny, and fair. It was this sweet spot in my life where I didn't spend a lot of time questioning my worth. I owned what I had, and didn't sweat the rest. Then I got to college, where the class of freshman girls at my school, Towson University in Maryland, had just been voted Playboy magazine's number one hottest in the nation, and not because of me. All of a sudden, being witty and charismatic didn't mean shit. Day after day, I could feel the confidence draining from my body. I was not what these guys wanted. They wanted thinner, blonder, dumber. My sassy one-liners were only working with the cafeteria employees, who I was visiting all too frequently, tacking on the freshman 30, not 15, in record-breaking time. No males were noticing me, and I'm embarrassed to say it was killing me. The closest thing to attention I got came from this guy, Brett. He was 5 years older than me and looked like a Hitler youth. He was also a super senior, which is a sexy way of saying he should have graduated but needed or wanted another year before entering the real world. He barely ever spoke, which was perfect for all the projecting I had planned for him. Getting attention from a cute older boy felt like success. I'd get nervous to see him on campus. My heart would race, and I'd smile as he passed and look him in the eyes and feel all the blood rush to my face. I'd spend my time analyzing that interaction and planning my outfit for the next time I saw him. Should I wear simple clogs or reef sandals? Will he be at the bar tonight? This calls for a zebra print mini and a tube top. I wanted him to call, but he never called. And then one day, he called. It was 8 a.m. when my dorm room phone rang. Amy, sup? It's Brett. Come over. Holy shit, this is it, I thought. He woke up thinking about me. He realized we were meant to start a life together, that we should stop all this pretending that we weren't created just to love one another. I wonder where we'll raise our kids. Does he want to raise our family in Baltimore? I'll settle where he's most comfortable. I don't need to raise our kids Jewish, but I certainly won't have them christened. I shaved my legs in the sink and splashed some water on my armpits. My roommate stared at me from under her sheets as I rushed around our shitty dorm room, which in retrospect was not unlike a prison. Neon lighting, randomly assigned roommate, and sealed windows so we didn't have the option to jump to an early graduation. I ran right over there, ready for our day together. What would we do? It was still early enough to go fishing. Or maybe his mom was in town and they wanted me to join them for breakfast. Knock, knock. I beamed at the door. Knock, knock. Is he going to carry me over the threshold? I bet he's fixing his hair and telling his mom, "Be cool. This may be the one." I planned to be very sweet with her, but also to assert myself, so she didn't think she was completely in charge of all the holiday dinners we'd be spending together. I'd call her by her first name too early, so she'd realize she couldn't mess with me. "Rita, I'm going to make the green bean casserole this year." Knock, 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 knock! Finally, the door opened. It was Brett, but he wasn't really there. His face was distorted from alcohol consumption and whatever else. His eyes seemed like they'd left his body. They couldn't focus on me. He was standing next to me trying to see me from the side like a shark. "Hey!" he yelled a few notches too loudly and gave me a painfully hard hug. But I was too busy tilting up my chin, sticking out my boobs, and sucking in my stomach to notice this huge red flag. He was fucking wasted. I quickly realized that I wasn't the first person he thought of that morning. I was the last person he'd thought of the night before. Because for Brett, it still was the night before. I wondered how many girls didn't answer before he got to fat freshman me. Was I in his phone as Schumer? Probably took him a while to get to S. But there I was in his room, 18 years old and wanting to be held and touched and to feel desired. I wanted to be with him, and I imagined us on campus together holding hands, proving that I was lovable and that I couldn't be the troll doll I thought I'd become. Because this cool older guy liked me. I thought, I'll stay till he's sober and we can laugh about the whole thing and realize we really like each other. He put on some music and we got into bed. Well, he pushed me on the bed as a sexy maneuver. The move guys so often do to communicate, "Get ready, I'm taking the wheel on this one and I'm gonna blow your mind." It's almost never followed up with anything. He smelled like skunked Heineken, skunk, and Micro Magic cheeseburgers, which I planned to find and eat in the bathroom once he was asleep. His 9 a.m. shadow scratched my face when he came at me. I knew it would look like I had fruit punch mouth for days after this. And his alcohol-swollen kisses made me feel like I was being tongued by someone who'd just been given Novocaine. The music was too loud. I felt faceless and nameless. I was just a warm body, but I felt freezing cold as his fingers poked inside me like he'd lost his keys in there. Then came the sex. I use that word loosely. His penis had all the hardness of an empty banana peel. I knew a few minutes after I walked in that there was no chance of any sort of intercourse, which was good, because I wasn't ready to actually sleep with him. There was a better chance of a baby climbing Everest than this guy penetrating me. During this festival of flailing, I looked around the room to try to distract myself, or God willing, dissociate. The place looked like it had been decorated by an overeager set designer who took the note temporary and without substance too far. I saw a Scarface poster, which of course was mandatory. Anything else? No, that was it. This standard white dude, son of an accountant who played more video games in hacky sack than I was comfortable with, felt the greatest connection with a Cuban refugee drug lord. He started to go down on me. That's ambitious, I thought. Is it still considered getting head if the guy falls asleep after 3 seconds of moving his tongue like an elderly person eating their last oatmeal? The only wetness coming from between my legs was his drool, because he'd fallen completely asleep and was snoring into me. I wanted to scream out for myself. Get out of here, Amy! You are beautiful, you are smart, and you are worth more than this. I sighed and heard my own heart break. I was fighting back tears. I could feel I was losing myself to the girl in this bed, almost completely. Then I noticed a change in the music. The song was a bagpipe solo. Brett, what is this? I shook him awake. The Braveheart soundtrack, he answered. Of course, I should have known. I bet his Mel Gibson poster was in the mail, on its way to hang on the wall proudly next to Al Pacino. Can you put something else on, please? He rose grumpily, fell to the floor, and crawled. I looked at his exposed butt crack, a dark, unkempt abyss that I was falling into. I was short of breath. I felt paralyzed. His asshole was a canyon. This was my 127 hours. I needed to chip away at that rock and get out. Brett stood up and put on a new CD. Darling, you send me. He climbed back in bed and tried to mash what was at this point his third ball into my vagina. On his fourth thrust, he gave up and fell asleep again on my breasts. His head was heavy and his breath so sour I had to turn my head so my eyes didn't water. But they already were watering because of this album, these songs. Who is this? I asked. The music was so beautiful. The songs were gutting me. Cupid, draw back your bow. The score he'd attached to our morning could not have been more off. His sloppy attempt at lovemaking was more Mel Gibson than William Wallace. And now the most beautiful love songs I'd ever heard rang out as this man-boy lay in my arms after diminishing me to a last attempt at a booty call. I listened, and I cried. I looked down at myself from the ceiling fan, as if I were my own fairy godmother. I waited until the last perfect note, then slid out from under him and slipped out the door. I closed it behind me, and I was rescued. I never heard from Brett again, so I never got to thank him for introducing me to my new self and my new love, Sam Cooke. 13 years later, I still love Sam Cooke, and I still need that fairy godmother from time to time. As a part of my TV show, I have a segment called Amy Goes Deep, where I interview people who do interesting jobs or have interesting lifestyles. One segment I did that we didn't end up airing was with a professional matchmaker. In addition to letting me ask her questions about her job, she wanted to set me up. Directly after we filmed our conversation, I was going to meet up with the man she'd chosen for me. It was the most disturbing Amy Goes Deep scene I've taped. Keep in mind I've talked to a climate change denier, a pickup artist, and a diagnosed sociopath. But this woman left the darkest cloud over me. It still makes me feel angry and demoralized. Before we met, she'd sized me up from pictures online and some footage of my performances. She told me very little about the guy she was going to set me up with, but emphasized that he was a great catch. She described him as a 6-foot-tall, nice-looking guy who worked out. She assured me that he was funny and that he always made people laugh with the insightful things he wrote on Facebook. She went on to instruct me about the benefits of this quality as if she were speaking to an alien who'd never experienced human emotion before. When there's great banter, it's really fun and easy, and you feel sexual chemistry happening. Hearing her teaching me, a 34-year-old comic, about sexual attraction and humor in this controlling, prescribed way, was making the bile rise in my throat. She asked what icebreaker I'd use to talk to a guy. I asked if she thought I should push his head down like I was setting off dynamite. No, she said, completely humorlessly, because the guy is supposed to be the one doing that. You're the woman, she informed me. You need to be a lady. You need to make it so that he likes you, so that there's a hint of what's to come. I think you just need to sit back and let him take control. She then informed me that my numerous sex jokes were probably the reason I was still single. How can I say this like a lady? Suck my dick! If you've seen my show, you know that I expose every part of myself on screen. I wear unattractive costumes and show my body from all angles. I write about things that I'm truly sensitive about, and I'm often the butt of the joke. But this interview with the matchmaker was hands down the most vulnerable I've ever felt. Hearing a dating expert inform me why I'm not attractive to men, and then having to put myself out there to meet a man she selected who might actually be interested in me, was very scary. When the interview finished, I went to a bar to meet the guy, whom I'll call Rex. I'm feeling dizzy even writing this now. I waited at the bar, all of my self-worth leaking out of my sweaty palms, which were gripping a glass of wine like it was the only thing connecting me to the rest of the world. I had a bad feeling, but nothing could have prepared me for who walked in the door. When I saw Rex, I felt like the Titanic, and he was the cluster of icebergs that would finally destroy me. In he walked. He was about 53 years old, wearing a denim button-down shirt with a leather vest over it. He was around 5'9", a solid 3 inches shorter than the matchmaker's description, and had hair plugs and a significant belly. He was not afraid of exposing his salt-and-pepper chest hair, having left open his top 4 buttons, which also allowed him to showcase, no joke, a shark-tooth necklace. His own teeth had been freshly whitened, and he couldn't wait to flash them as often as possible, which wasn't difficult because he was so excited about his tan that he couldn't stop smiling. I bought him a drink after we hugged hello. My heart had dropped out of the bottom of my vagina, and the clock was running the second we locked eyes. I am giving this exactly 30 minutes, I thought. I focused all my energy on being as kind as possible. He asked me no questions, which I appreciated, because I just wasn't in the sharing mood. There was no time anyway, because he needed to tell me about his band that did Bruce or Billy covers. He talked a lot about the kind of guy he was. He stared at my tits, and I witnessed the moment he decided he'd be willing to have sex with me. I was focusing on my breathing and the clock. I was smiling and trying to spread joy, but it was hard because this guy was actually cocky and a dick. I started to wrap things up at about 22 minutes in. I said I had so much work to do and how great it was to meet him. He then said exactly this. "You are really cute. The matchmaker told me you were, quote, no model, but I think she's wrong." This made my heart, which had already fallen out of my pussy, proceed to dig a hole through the earth's crust, mantle, and core. Was this supposed to be the great banter the matchmaker foreshadowed? Was the sexual chemistry right around the corner? I wanted to be sure I'd heard him correctly. "What exactly did she say?" I asked. "Well," Rex proceeded to explain, "I wasn't sure I wanted to go on this date and was nervous about it, and she said, 'Don't worry, she's no model.'" I pointed out to him how rude it was to relay this information to me. I could have done without hearing her assessment of my appearance. He defended himself by saying that he disagreed with the matchmaker. I started to lay out for him why this was still a shitty thing for him to say to me. But then I thought, fuck it. Why am I engaging with a dude who was born when Eisenhower was president and who loves wearing dead shark parts close to his heart? I thanked him for his time, hugged him goodbye, and left, decimated. Not for myself, but for all the single women out there trying to date. I wanted to run to the top of the Empire State Building and make an announcement to all of them to let them know they are worth so much more than this. That they don't need to wrangle some warm body to sit next to them just so they aren't alone on holidays. That they should never let a magazine or dating site or matchmaker monster tell them they're in a lower bracket of desirability because of their age or weight or face or sense of humor. That they don't deserve to be manipulated into thinking this is something they should strive for. This decaying turkey of a man who'd been encouraged to believe, like so many other men, that he was a great prize for someone like me. Why should I have worked so hard to keep him interested, as the matchmaker suggested women are supposed to do? He wasn't funny, he wasn't particularly nice, and I've been more interested talking to people's pets. And as for the matchmaker, she makes her living redefining women's dreams, telling them to lower their expectations. She creates and confirms what she thinks you deserve. If you are no model, I guess she thinks your best hope is to be matched with a man who has a pulse and a bank account, and that you should be grateful if he musters an erection with your name on it. I walked out of there like the building was on fire, and I had started it, thinking, fuck that. I'm not going to lie in that freshman dorm bed or sit in that bar with Rex and his vest ever again. And for anyone who has ever looked for love and found nothing more than a denim-on-denim-on-leather-wearing, hair-club-for-men dude, I want to say, love yourself. You don't need a man or a boy or a self-proclaimed love expert to tell you what you're worth. Your power comes from who you are and what you do. You don't need all that noise, that constant hum in the background telling you whether or not you're good enough. All you need is you, your friends and your family, and you will find the right person for you, if that's what you want, the one who respects your strength and beauty. Most of the time these days, I feel beautiful and strong. I walk proudly down the streets of Manhattan, that same girl I was during my senior year of high school. The people I love love me. I'm a great sister and friend. I make the funniest people in the country laugh. My vagina has had an impressive guest list, truly an inspiring roster of men. I have fought my way through harsh criticism and death threats, and I am alive. I am fearless, most of the time. But I can still be reduced to that lonely, vulnerable college freshman pretty quickly. It happened that day with the matchmaker and Rex, and I'm sure it will happen again. I'm not bulletproof, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this. As women, we relive our fears all the time, despite our best efforts to build each other up and truly love ourselves. It happens. And when it does, sometimes Sam Cooke isn't enough, and I can't fairy godmother my way out of it. Sometimes I want to quit, not performing, but being a woman altogether. I want to throw my hands in the air after reading a mean Twitter comment and say, "All right, you've got me. You figured me out. I'm not pretty. I'm not thin. I don't deserve love. I have no right to use my voice. I will start wearing a burqa and move to a small town upstate and wait tables at a pancake house." So much has changed about me since I was that confident, happy girl in high school. In the years since then, I've experienced a lot of desperation and self-doubt, but in a way, I've come full circle. I know my worth. I embrace my power. I say if I'm beautiful. I say if I'm strong. You will not determine my story. I will. I'll speak and share and fuck and love, and I will never apologize for it. I am amazing for you, not because of you. I am not who I sleep with. I am not my weight. I am not my mother. I am myself, and I am all of you. Excerpt from my journal in 2003, age 22, with footnotes from 2016. Dear Journal, well, it's always a bad sign when I'm not writing. It really means I have something to hide, or that I'm not living in reality, and don't want to think about it. Footnote. I like that I believe my journal was this priest I had to confess my sins to. I had this unwritten contract to keep shit real with my journal. This past 2 months have been no exception. Footnote. It's also a bad sign when a writer uses this instead of these when talking about something plural. Crushing it, Amy! I am now in New York on the train on my way to try and get a fabulous waitressing job in the city. Footnote. I honestly don't know if I was joking or not with the word fabulous, but what I learned quickly was that there are no fabulous waitressing jobs, or bartending jobs, or any service industry jobs, except maybe there's a professional head-getter. Is that a job? You just lie there and get head? That sounds fabulous. I've been living in a world mirroring reality, but not quite a part of it. Footnote. I would love to know what the fuck I'm talking about here. I must have been reading a heavy-handed Oprah book club pick. I graduated from college. Blah, blah, blah. What exactly does that mean? Footnote. I have a point here. To this day, I maintain that going to college is not essential if you want to be an actor, especially if you truly want to perform. Read some plays and study in an intensive course with a technique that is the most useful for you. I liked the Meisner technique. So I studied that for a couple years after college with William Esper. I think I know, but I've learned that the present truth becomes the future's nonsense. Footnote. Slow down, Nietzsche. This is utter garbage. Just babble. I am embarrassed for myself. But that's part of reading from a journal. The last 2 months of school were busy, but great. The play went pretty well. It could have been 1,000 times better, but the director was the worst ever and the cast sucked, too. Footnote. Pretty harsh, Amy Ford Coppola. What did I expect? It was a state school in Maryland. Did I want Mark Rylance and Meryl Streep to co-star with me? We were a bunch of teenagers playing adults. Relax. I am trying to begin my life. Footnote. I remember this feeling so well. Since I was 10, I'd wanted to feel like life was really starting, and it all wasn't just this prep for it. I want everything right now. Footnote. I did. I want to be living in NYC. Footnote. I do. Getting paid. Footnote, I do. To act and bartend. Footnote, I like that I was realistic enough to know that I would have to bartend and that I included it in my dream. I upgraded from waitressing to bartending in this one journal entry. I've only been home a week and I'm already itching to be raking in cash and going on auditions. Footnote, little did I know that auditions are what nightmares are made of. You are judged by a room full of people who have no respect for you as you read for a role you will not get. I want to start a new page. Footnote, I would like for you to believe that I was being poetic and metaphorical here, but I literally meant I wanted to start a new page of the journal entry. There was a whole line left, but I drew an arrow because I was sick of looking at that page. How to become a stand-up comedian. Stand-up is my favorite thing to do. Well, that's not true. I love to have an orgasm, and I love to watch a good movie or read a good book. I love to eat pasta and drink wine. Those things are probably my favorites. But after those things, oh wait, sleep. I love to sleep, and I love to be on a boat. I love to play volleyball with my sister, and I love to go see a band or musician's concert right when I'm at my peak of loving them. Those are all my favorite things to do. But all joking aside, even though I'm not joking, stand-up is such a huge joy for me. Especially now, because even though you get better and better at it, the experience doesn't change. Or at least that's how I feel. Standing up there on stage, under the lights, and expressing something you think is funny or important or both, and being met with laughter, applause, appreciation, and agreement is a feeling I can't describe. I am a human being and I want to be loved, and some nights I just want to sit around watching movies with my family or my boyfriend, but mostly every night for the last 13 years, I've wanted to get on stage. My first official gig was at the age of 5. I played Gretel in The Sound of Music. But I was performing even before that, for as long as I could speak. In my room as a child, the bed was placed on a platform in a nook that was built into the wall. There were curtains around the nook to create a cozy little place to sleep, but I moved the mattress out so the platform could be my stage instead. I'd gather any family members I could find, emerge from behind the curtain, and perform for them on my little stage. The performances consisted mostly of me telling boring, meandering stories about bunnies or cats or worms. They pretended they were interested, even though they must have been dying for a meteor to drop on the house. I always wanted to perform. My dad filmed everything, which constantly annoyed me. Even as a toddler, I'd stop my performance and ask him to put down the camera. We have a video of me throwing a tantrum because he wouldn't obey my demands to stop filming. You'd think I would have enjoyed being filmed, but for me, the experience was all about the audience and the live show. Even when I was 3. My first time going on stage to do stand-up was very last minute. I was 23 years old and had been out of college for 2 years. A woman in an improv group I was in, a comic of about 45, had been doing stand-up for a long time. She was like a female Woody Allen without the marrying someone who was once his daughter. I went to see her perform one night, and like every other asshole who goes to comedy clubs, I thought, I could do this. Not long after that fateful night, I discovered Gotham Comedy Club. It was on 22nd Street at the time and seated about 150 people. I went in and found out that if I brought 4 people to be in the audience, people who would pay the door price and purchase some drinks, I could perform that night. I can't remember who all 4 of these lucky souls were. One was definitely my mom, and another was my friend, Eileen, a jazz drummer. But I don't remember the others. I had a couple hours before I went on stage, during which I brainstormed the 6-minute set I'd perform. The show was at 5 p.m. on a Tuesday. Still light outside. Great time for comedy. There were about 25 people in the audience. I unfortunately have a videotape of the whole thing. My hair is very curly, and the only thing worse than my outfit was my jokes. I wore a Mormon-looking short-sleeved white button-down with jeans that would have fit the original version of Jared from Subway, and I ranted about skywriting. It's so annoying, it always fades, and you can never really read it. If a guy proposed to me that way, I would say no. And then I added, so do me a favor this summer. Keep it at eye level. That was my clever little sum up. Keep it at eye level. Blech. I could vomit thinking about how awful my act was. But I wasn't nervous. I've been doing theater since I was 5, so I didn't have stage fright. I was pretty confident for a newcomer with 0 original thoughts and even less timing. People laughed enough, They laughed because I was young and hopeful, and they could feel my energy and enthusiasm. They laughed to be nice. All that mattered was that they laughed. I was in. Some of the actual comedians there complimented me. They told me I should work at it, and that I could get better. Maybe they were trying to sleep with me. Wait, just remembered my outfit. They weren't. From then on, I did a couple shows a month. Always bringers. Which means you have to bring between 8 and 12 people to sit in the audience and buy drinks in exchange for 6 minutes of stage time. It's a bit of a racket, but everyone gets what they want. Everyone except the audience. I'd usually rely on my family and friends from Long Island and whomever I was waiting tables with at the time to fulfill my audience quota. It was brutal to need something from people all the time. Later on down the line, as soon as I stopped doing bringers, I deleted about 100 numbers from my cell phone. I was thrilled I wouldn't ever have to text, "Hey, want to come to my show?" As I have said before, I'm an introvert, and after shows, I just want to go home and think about my set. But instead, I'd have to go to a bar with everyone who came to support me. Doing a show already takes a lot out of you, but then to have to kind of work a room was too much. It seemed easier to give a lap dance to an angry porcupine than to stand around with my restaurant coworkers hearing what they thought of my punchlines. My first year of stand-up, I'd pace in the parking lot outside Gotham before the show. I'd walk back and forth past the valet attendants and go over the set in my head the way an actor goes over a monologue. Over and over again. Then, when I was a few minutes away from being called on stage, I'd get diarrhea. Every time. It was almost a ritual. I'd panic at the thought that they'd call my name while I was still in a cold bathroom, wiping myself within an inch of my life. But it always timed out well. Somehow, I consistently managed to empty my bowels, wipe, and flush before my name was called. I even had a few extra seconds to stretch like a long-distance runner before I had to go on. Which I always did. Until I saw someone shadowboxing before they went on stage and thought it was so lame that I quit my own ritual of stretching. Now I can be fully asleep or in the middle of a conversation and walk on stage, but back then it was like sacrificing a lamb with all the creepy superstitions I had. The strangest one was watching myself. You could buy a VHS tape of your performance from a guy at Gotham for $15. I didn't have a VCR at home, so I'd bring the tape to a store that rhymes with Best Buy and put it in one of their machines so I could watch my set and take notes. People shopping would walk by so confused as to why a girl had brought a video of herself to a store and was writing about it. Or once someone thought I was on a really low-budget TV show that I'd happened to catch the airing of, but I couldn't afford a VCR with all the money I was spending on stage time and rent. I didn't graduate to open mic shows for a while. Open mics are a bigger step because they aren't bringers, and a lot of the time the audience consists only of other comedians. I decided a good place to get my feet wet would be up in Harlem on 106th Street at a place called The Underground. I went up with a lot of confidence. I'd been performing for months in front of real audiences with a couple hundred people in them, so I thought I could handle 30 comedians. I'm singing these three words. No, I couldn't. I bombed hard. Not one laugh. There's nothing quite like your first bomb. You can feel it in your bones. First you think there might be something wrong with the sound, but there isn't. It's you. You're the problem. You and your terrible jokes that are not funny. You realize everyone has been lying to you. There are no friends in the audience laughing so as not to hurt your self-esteem. It's a sea of unfriendly faces. People who do the same thing you do, so they don't think you're cute. They think you are boring and that you're wasting their time. And all they are focused on is their own set and how they should be further along in comedy than they are. I was dizzy when I got off stage. I sat back down with a few other comics who smiled at me in a sorry-for-your-loss way. I hung my head through the rest of the show and realized I had a lot of work to do. I didn't cry, but my confidence was in tiny little pieces shattered all over the dirty Harlem floor. Okay, fine, I cried. Then I drank several warm beers. From there, I began doing a couple shows a week, an open mic here and a bringer there. I'd finish one set and go home to have dinner with my boyfriend, Rick, with whom I lived very happily in Brooklyn. We were both actors who met waiting tables, meaning we were both auditioning for shitty roles in shitty plays and not getting any parts. I remember thinking it was strange that a lot of other comics I knew would do more than one show a night. I could feel their insatiable hunger for stage time, and I pitied them. What were they chasing? As if one more 5-minute set at a hair salon, yes, they have shows everywhere, in front of 10 other drunk open mic performers would change anything. And then it happened to me. I thought of my first good joke, the kind that made me feel I had to get on stage to tell it. It happened on the L train on my way home to Williamsburg around 1 a.m. I was sitting next to an elderly black woman, and we were having a nice conversation, just chit-chat. She was cryptkeeper old, like a California raisin. That is not racist. If she had been white, she would have looked like a yellow California raisin. Anyhoozle. Out of nowhere, she asked me, "Have you heard the good news?" At that moment, I saw she had one of those cartoony religious pamphlets, and I realized she was trying to save my soul. I let her down easily, explaining that I was Jewish and would not be joining her in the kingdom of heaven. That was that. I thought she was just this sweet woman I was connecting with, but she was using me to get salvation points. Little did she know I was a godless, shifty Jew. I walked home from the subway thinking about the interaction, and I wrote a joke. A good joke. I called my sister early the next morning and woke her up. Kim hates being woken up, but she sleeps with her phone on, and I know that. So ring, ring, ring. "Kim, listen, I have a new joke." She answered me with a supportive, "Goodbye," but I got her to stay on the phone and listen to my joke, which was, this old woman on the subway asked me, "Have you heard the good news?" She was trying to save me. I said, "Ma'am, I'm so sorry. My people are Jewish." She said, "That's okay. Your people just haven't found Jesus yet." I said, "No, we found him. Maybe you haven't heard the bad news." I listened into my phone for Kim's response, like I had so many times before. After about 3 Mississippis, she said, "That's funny. Goodbye." And she hung up. But that was all I needed. I loved my new joke. I tried it that night in an open mic, and it went well. But I started working on it. Maybe if I added a couple of wrong guesses of what I thought the good news was, it could be funnier. I went to another open mic, and then another. A couple weeks later, I wrote a new joke. My boyfriend is always turning the lights on when we have sex, and I shut them off, and he puts them back on. The other day he said, "Why are you so shy? You have a beautiful body." I said, "You're so cute. You think I don't want you to see me?" I loved that joke. I wanted to run it a million times, and I did. I found out there were some clubs where you could bark, which meant standing on a corner and giving out flyers, telling people about a comedy show. "Hey, do you like live comedy? Have you heard those annoying people when you visited New York?" Well, that was me. In 10-degree weather, I'd be out there on a corner trying to get enough people inside so they would let me go on stage. I needed bodies in there, English-speaking or not. I had caught the bug. I was totally and completely addicted to stand-up, to getting better at it, and it was working. It turns out if you do a ton of open mics and bringers, and if you bark, and if you produce your own shows, and if you have other comics in your shows, and if they have you in their shows, and if you do it every single night several times, and if you are totally obsessed with it, you will get a little better. Little is the key word. Ultimately, anyone who does stand-up is delusional and masochistic. It takes so much work and so much time to be good. To get real laughs requires years and years. I got better little by little. A comic, Pete Dominic, whom I met doing a bringer at Gotham, pushed me hard to get better. He said, "You need to know the name of every club in New York, and you need to get up whenever you can. It has to be an obsession." He was right. Jessica Kearson was the funniest person I'd ever seen. I used to watch her close out the shows at Gotham. She would kill in a way I still haven't seen anyone else do. The audience was physically exhausted from laughing when she got off stage. Your face hurt. She was the first person to let me open for her on the road. I'd go anywhere for nothing. She would give me $50 to be nice, but I was just thrilled she would take me with her. Then, one day, about 2.5 years in, I went to a free seminar for new comics at Gotham Comedy Club, the place where I did my first stand-up set. The owner, Chris Mazzilli, had arranged for an agent and a nationally headlining comic to be there to answer the questions of about 100 comics in attendance. I was furiously taking notes while Chris was talking about the importance of working hard. I'll never forget when he said to the group of hungry comedians, "A good example of a hard-working comic is Amy Schumer. She doesn't know it yet, but I'm recommending her to be a new face at the Montreal Comedy Festival." This was all news to me. I was thrilled he even knew my name. I almost started crying, because he was the first person of authority to make it clear to me that he felt I had something special. I had an open mic show right after at a bar. I stepped outside in the rain to head over, and it was like that scene in 50 Shades of Grey after Anastasia meets Christian. Yes, I saw it, and so did you. Except I wasn't feeling this way about a hot guy who was going to be dominating me and fucking me in every hole. I was feeling this way about comedy. I don't remember how that open mic went, or if any of my jokes worked that night. I just remember feeling like I was flying, knowing that it didn't matter how that show went. All 20 people in the audience could have stonewalled me. I wouldn't have cared. I had major adrenaline running through my veins, and I believed I had a real chance to make it. I didn't know what that meant, but I could feel something was coming. Soon after, in 2006, I got a college agent. I'd be paid $100 to open for other comedians at universities, sometimes traveling for 8 hours to get to one. My first college show was at Bryn Mawr in Pennsylvania, where I opened for a comic named Kyle Dunnigan. Half the crowd walked out during my set, and the other half walked out during his. Kyle is now, 10 years later, one of my very best friends, and has been a writer on my TV show for 4 years. He is one of the funniest people I know. By the end of 2006, I started headlining colleges. The day I found out I was going to be making $800 for 1 hour, I was running laps in my Brooklyn apartment thinking to myself, would I be this happy if I ever had a baby? I think the answer was no. After that, I got to do a 7-minute special on a Comedy Central show called Live at Gotham. I killed and blacked out from excitement. I couldn't believe I was getting to do stand-up on television after only 2.5 years. And then the most unlikely thing of all happened, when I auditioned for NBC's program Last Comic Standing, an American Idol-type reality show for comics that was about to tape its 5th season. I didn't think I had a chance. I thought if I got lucky, they might use my audition footage as part of a montage in the first episode, or that maybe I would at least lay the groundwork to make it on the show a few years down the road. That was my real thinking. The audition consisted of doing stand-up in front of 3 judges. After this first round, about 200 were cut, and some 30 people were invited to perform in the next round, which was an evening show to take place that same night. I called my mom and my boyfriend, and they came to the show. At the end of the night, they stood us all in humiliating rows on risers to announce who would receive the red envelopes, which were tickets to Los Angeles to perform in the semifinals. I stood there knowing I wouldn't get an envelope, and that I would have to stay put while they called all the winners down one by one. My face was turning the color of those envelopes. But then they read my name. My eyes bugged out of my head, and I ran forward like a contestant being called down on The Price is Right. They handed me my envelope, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't take my eyes off it. I felt like Charlie with his golden ticket. I looked at my mom and my boyfriend. We were all screaming with shock and excitement. The 2 months leading up to the semifinals in L.A., I worked out hard every day at the gym and did stand-up every single night. I was out in L.A. all by myself, staying at a hotel with comedians from all over the country and some from around the world. I was so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. "The hotel has a pool," I announced around a lunch table full of comics who had been on the road for as long as I'd been alive. Everyone was very nice to me, despite how annoying I must have been. I was the least experienced of the bunch. When it came time for the big live taping that would determine which 10 comics would compete on the show, I was ready. I wore a V-neck shirt from Express and almost no makeup. Someone told me there would be 900 people in the audience. The most I'd ever performed for was about 200. A producer of the show said, "Amy, 8 million people will see this on television." But for some reason, that didn't matter to me as much as the 900 live people who would be sitting in front of me. I assumed I would be eliminated, so I just promised myself I'd do the best I could and enjoy every second of it. And I did. At the end, when it came time to announce the top 10 people who would be competing, my name was read 9th. Amy Schumer? I couldn't fucking believe it. I ran out on stage and waved like I had won a pageant. I cried. All that really happened was I made it onto a reality show, which was pretty much just casting. It's not that I was funnier than the rest of the comics. I was just a good character for the show. But I knew none of that at the time, and I'm so glad I didn't. Being on that show was so intense and exciting. Each episode consisted of a different challenge, and strangely, I was the most prepped for these challenges. The other comics were seasoned road dogs who were used to relying on their well-crafted jokes and long stories they told doing 60 to 90 minute headlining sets on the road. But I only had about 15 minutes of material, and it all worked in little sound bites, so it was perfect for a reality show. I was up for thinking on my feet, and they weren't. The final challenge determined the top five comics who got to go on a national tour together, which would have been great for anyone's career, mine especially. It was explained to all of us that the challenge was going to consist of making models laugh. We would go room to room, one at a time, and do a joke or two for them. I remember saying, "Aren't you guys tired of only being appreciated for your brains?" They laughed. A bell went off to indicate that I was supposed to go to the next room. In the next room sat a clown. There were no more models to entertain. The production had, of course, tricked us. And the next rooms consisted of a drill sergeant, a transvestite, and a nun. I told my Jesus bad news joke to the nun, and she laughed. I did my best, but assumed I was going home. The people from each room voted on their favorite comic, and when we all lined up for the results, I was shocked to hear I had won. Thanks to the clown, the nun, the models, and the transvestite, I was going on the tour. I was thrilled for about 10 seconds, until one of the comics, who also wound up in the top five, leaned over to me and said, "You don't deserve it." I ran into the bathroom and cried, because at the time, I believed him. I was paranoid that I hadn't actually been the funniest, that maybe the producers rigged the results in order to keep me on the show, since I was the young female comic who was good for their ratings. They wanted to film me while I cried, but I wouldn't come out of the stall. I refused to be a girl on reality TV sobbing and being a victim. I wanted to be strong. Later, when I watched the episode air, I saw that without question, I'd performed the best. One of the producers, Paige Hurwitz, said, "Amy, it wasn't even close. You won." Nothing bad to say about that comic who told me I didn't deserve it, but fuck that guy, right? I ended up getting eliminated on the next episode, earning myself fourth place on the show, along with the opportunity to tour the country on a giant rock star tour bus with four men in their 40s. We performed in 42 theaters to crowds of about 2,000 to 4,000 people, the kind of places I'd never performed in before in my life. I bombed pretty much every single night. 42 cities, and I think I ate it in about 40 of them. I wasn't ready. I didn't have the roadwork under my belt. You can fake it for 7 minutes, even 15, if you're charismatic enough. But when you're doing nearly a half hour, people are going to see what you're made of. And at that point, I was made of less than 3 years. Not only was I short on material, I wasn't confident about my jokes yet. Because I shouldn't have been. I didn't have the experience to sell it up there. I'd cry in my bunk on the bus. One of the comics said he thought I was talented, but would never make it as a stand-up. It hurt. Looking back now, I can see clearly how experienced comics can get bitter. It's a tough business, and often things don't work out the way you think they will. But the rage and jealousy comics can feel for others' success is a highly toxic waste of time. I want to go back to those days knowing what I know now and say to that comic, focus on your own goals and how to achieve them. No one took your spot. There's room for all of us. Anyway, the bus and hotel life on that tour was hard for me. I was lonely and not doing well. One night after a show, I got on an elevator and a little old woman said, "Which floor?" And I didn't know. I started crying because I couldn't remember where I was. This sad moment is something most road comics, and I'm assuming musicians, can relate to. I had no idea how frequently this would happen to me over the years. It happens all the time. But even though it was difficult, that tour was also my personal comedy boot camp. I'd logged enough hours bombing and sweating on stage that my molecules were permanently altered. Stand-up recalibrates your fear sensors. It thickens your skin in ways that come in handy all the time. Clocking so many hours under all those lights while people in the crowd are viewing every expression and hearing every inflection, hanging on every word, just waiting to be moved by you. Or to boo you. This experience over and over again can only make you stronger. I think for anyone to become good at something, they have to fail a lot too. And they have to be completely unafraid to fail, or they'll never make it to the next level. I did so bad for so long in front of so many people on that tour that I stopped caring. I got desensitized to crowds not liking my jokes. I lost the protective shell that holds so many of us back, and I just started going for it. This, in turn, made me own the crowd. Once you own your jokes and stand by them, you can relax. Being tentative sours the crowd. They see your fear, and then they can't laugh. They want to have fun, not worry about your next move. If they have to cringe or feel bad for you, their experience is ruined, and they are taken completely out of the moment. Like when you fart during sex. Sure, you can finish and go through the motions, but something has been lost. Once I figured this all out and wasn't seeking the audience's approval anymore, they were free to have a good time, relax, and enjoy. After the tour, I started headlining on my own for about a year, which is what doing well in a reality show will buy you. And then I went back to featuring, which is the middle spot after the MC and before the headliner. I was on the road for years with Jim Norton and Dave Attell, two of my all-time favorite comics. And the answer is no. Neither of them ever even tried anything with me. I should be insulted, but I'm not. It's the ultimate compliment to have someone take you on the road with them. They're saying, I think you're funny, and I also can stand to hang out and travel with you. Jimmy and his bodyguard, Club Soda Kenny, and I had a blast on the road. They lived to embarrass me, shouting my name across stores and hotel lobbies, inviting stares from everyone around us. Something they knew I hated when I was offstage. They loved making me blush, which I actually did a lot more of in those days. I am such a loud little sassafras on stage, but in real life I like to keep a very low profile, and those guys took every opportunity to destroy any hope I had of blending in. In 2012, I went back to headlining on my own in small clubs with under 200 seats. I would get paid about $2,000 for 7 shows. The weekends would go like this. Arrive on a Thursday and have an 8 p.m. show. Get picked up at 5:30 a.m. on Friday to do morning radio. Someone affiliated with the club, sometimes a crackhead, drives you from radio station to radio station. Sometimes there are local news shows to do on camera. If you're lucky, it's just 2 of each. But some clubs fuck you in the ass, and you have to do so many. And they say it's to get more tickets sold, but it doesn't usually translate to that, and is really just promotion for the shitty club. Arrive back in your hotel room by 11 a.m., hopefully if you're strong enough to refuse going out to breakfast or lunch with the crackhead driver or attention-hungry club owner who snuck on the radio appearance with you. Grab an apple and peanut butter from the depressing all-day buffet in the lobby because you've missed breakfast. Desperately try to go back to sleep, but this is impossible because your hotel is in a gross, dangerous neighborhood, so the club owner could save $75. Use the rusty hotel gym where the chlorine from the neighboring pool burns your eyes. Walk to a Red Robin and try to eat healthy, even though they have not heard of vegetables in most of the country. So you get a grilled chicken something that comes with garlic bread and ice cream, and you realize why Americans are dying. Go back to your room and feel utterly alone. Text an ex. Watch some movie made for TV about a woman who murdered her husband. Shower and get ready for your 2 Friday evening shows. And yes, I know you probably noticed I didn't shower right after the gym, but waited till evening instead. You do you, and I'll do me. Do 2, sometimes 3 shows. Wake up Saturday morning and repeat a lot of Friday, including working out in the rusty-ass gym again, and hope the red, itchy, new thing on your knee is a rash from said gym and not from a bed bug. Sometimes during the day on Saturday, to pass the time, you go to whatever local attraction there is. A museum, a place where someone famous was shot, or maybe a fort. Eat whatever food is local to that city, because it is your duty to do so. If you're in Philly, you eat a cheesesteak. If you're in Brooklyn, a cheesecake. If you're in Cincinnati, skyline chili. If you're in Tulsa, they don't really have a thing, but someone may tell you, you have to try our pork fried hamburger, or some weird shit. You gotta eat it. Show them some goddamn respect, and then tweet them pictures of you on the toilet as a way to say, thank you! Get ready for your Saturday night shows. Do 2, sometimes 3 shows. Because you're a girl, you don't hook up after the show. Maybe you have a drink with the staff, or maybe you go back to the hotel and get room service if they're still serving it. But usually the hotel you're at doesn't have room service at all. Lie awake in bed regretting that you just smoke pot because it's making you think about what you do for a living. Am I a clown? What do? I tell jokes to strangers while they eat nachos? It weirds you out, and you vow not to smoke pot alone on the road anymore. The club owner pays you after your last show. It feels like it takes forever for them to total up your share of the money, because it does, and they act like they are doing you a favor. They tell you you didn't make your $100 bonus, even though you could see every seat was filled. Sometimes they hand you a bill, and you realize you thought you were eating and drinking for free, but you only got 25% off the usual tab. Fly home early Monday morning and feel good about yourself because you developed 15 new seconds of your act that weekend. Even though the road can be brutal, it's the only way to become a stand-up. In order to get good at it, you must get as much stage time as humanly possible. Sure, you can learn how to kill on a shorter set, maybe even have a great 15 minutes. Or maybe you're good at local references in your city and can do really well there.